This recording is copyright. IELTSblog.com Listening Practice Tests. Test 6. In the IELTS test, you hear some recordings and you have to answer questions on them. You have time to read the instructions and questions and check your work. All recordings are played only once. The test is in 4 sections. Now turn to Section 1. Section 1. You will hear a conversation between a man and a woman about a home insurance claim. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 5. You will see that there is an example. This time only, the conversation relating to this will be played first.
Good morning.
Good morning. How can I help you?
I don't know if you remember me. I bought my car and home insurance here 8 months ago.
So, 8 months is the correct answer. Now the full test will begin. You should answer the questions as you listen, as the recording is not played twice. Listen carefully to the conversation and answer questions 1 to 5.
Good morning.
Good morning. How can I help you?
I don't know if you remember me. I bought my car and home insurance here 8 months ago.
Yes. I remember your face, but not your name, I'm afraid.
Oh, that's okay.
So, what can I do for you?
I'm afraid we had a break-in at our house. I wasn't very sure how to start the process for the claim, so I thought I'd come back to you. I hope that's all right.
Of course. I'm so sorry you've had burglars. I'd be very happy to help. So, here's a claim form. You used Clover Insurance, didn't you?
That's right.
I'll need to take some details first. First of all, I need the names on your home insurance policy.
It was my husband and I. My husband's name is Colin Hudson. That's Colin with one L, so it's C-O-L-I-N. Hudson is H-U-D-S-O-N. My first name is Millie, which is M-I-L-L-Y.
And what's your home address?
15 Battersea Avenue, Enford. The postcode is EN69GD.
Thank you. I'll just make a note of that. Do you have the home insurance policy document from Clover with you?
No, I'm afraid I left it at home. I meant to bring it, but with all that's been happening, it slipped my mind.
That's okay. Do you perhaps remember the policy number?
Actually, yes. I've got it written down here in my diary that I carry. It's JU731.
Good. Let's see what the next thing is. Ah, yes. There's a question about the type of policy you have with Clover. Do you know what kind of policy you signed up for? With Clover, it's usually basic, enhanced, or premium.
It was the premium policy. Even the enhanced policy didn't give us the level of protection we required.
That's good for you now. The policy will cover everything that's missing.
I hope so.
Now, I suppose the police have visited you?
That's right.
Have they given you a case number?
Yes. They said that we need it for this process, so I wrote it down in my diary as well. It's quite long and all numbers. It's 315-166-462.
Okay, I've got all that.
Before the conversation continues, you have some time to look at questions 6 to 10. Now listen carefully and answer questions 6 to 10.
Right, Mrs. Hudson. I need to take down some details of the burglary. Normally, you'd do this on the form, or you could do it online, but as I'm here, we can do it together.
Thanks very much.
No problem at all. Now, of course, the insurance company wants to know what things you want to claim for. This, of course, can be the things that were stolen, but as you've got the top-level insurance, Any damage, such as windows broken or doors forced, can be claimed for as well. You can also claim for any of the house keys and locks to be replaced, as thieves sometimes return to a house once they know they can break in more easily.
There was one window broken at the back, but the doors were all untouched. I don't think we need to worry about locks, as all the keys in the house were accounted for.
What burglars sometimes do is just take an impression for a key, so that people don't think to replace the locks.
Oh, really? We'd better do that then. There were keys lying around.
Now, what else?
Some valuable things went missing.
Yes, that's usual.
My jewellery is all gone. I've made a list here for you.
Thanks.
Fortunately, my husband and I were both wearing our watches, and my husband had his silver tie pin on the tie he was wearing. His silver picture frame with his family picture is gone, though. We also had quite a lot of cash in the house, around £500, but we had it cleverly hidden, so they didn't find it.
Well done.
The only other thing gone is a painting. It was hanging on the wall above an antique table, which they didn't take. It was quite valuable, so the thieves must have been quite knowledgeable to recognise that. The table was more valuable, and also had a valuable porcelain vase on it. The thieves didn't spot that either.
Is that all then?
Yes.
The final thing is to value everything.
I'm afraid that although I did that at home, I forgot that too. I can remember some things, though.
It doesn't matter. You can email me it all later.
That is the end of section one. You will now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section two. Section two. You will hear a man giving some people information about things to do in a seaside town. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 15. Now listen carefully to the information talk and answer questions 11 to 15.
Hello everyone, it's a lovely morning today and we're apparently going to get lots of sun later. Now here at the Seaview Hotel, we are very close to the beach and given the weather, I thought I'd just let you know what you can do there. If you leave the hotel from the back, take a left and follow the path down to the beach. You'll pass a mini golf on the way on the right. It's not that expensive and if you've had enough of the beach, it's a really fun way to spend an hour. When you get to the beach, you'll see the pier straight in front of you. It stretches out into the sea and is a nice walk out. It only costs a few dollars to walk on the pier, unless you want to go fishing, and then it costs a bit more. On the left of the pier, when you face the sea, there is, of course, the beach. You can lie down here and sunbathe. Swimming is very safe, but do check the large flags that the lifeguards put out. The lifeguards have their shed on the beach, here, just next to the pier. A green flag means that swimming is safe, and this is usually what you'll see. Every now and then, though, you'll see an orange flag. Then you shouldn't swim, usually because of a strong current. You'll see the flags at the back of the beach, just behind the lifeguard shed and the paved path, which I'll tell you about now. So, at the back of the beach, there is a large paved path. You can walk up and down this path at any time, as cars are not allowed here. Cyclists are allowed, but not between the hours of 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. A bit further down the beach, on the left as you walk down the path, you can rent a chair to sit on if you don't like lying on a towel, mat, or on the sand. Now, on the right of the pier as you face the sea is Moore Beach, where you can lie down and relax. At the back of the beach and over the path, just to the right of the pier, is a nice restaurant. It serves all sorts of things, from fish and chips to sandwiches and ice cream. They have a terrace on the roof where you can eat if the weather's nice, or you can go inside if you've had enough sun or if the weather's bad. Further down the beach on the right, you can rent a kayak. This is great fun, and you can take one out for 2 hours and get away from the crowds. It's essential if you rent a kayak that you know how to swim, and they will ask you that if you want to rent one. Also, They won't rent a kayak to anyone under the age of 16.
You now have some time to look at questions 16 to 20. Now listen to the rest of the information talk and answer questions 16 to 20.
After you've had your nice day at the beach, you will have the evening to enjoy. If you fancy watching some live entertainment, there are two places you can go. Firstly, there is the Playhouse Theatre, which this evening is presenting Murder in the Library. This is a crime play that is sure to be a lot of fun. This begins at 7:30 and ends at 10. Secondly, if you prefer some music, there is the Summer Showhouse, that tonight has a Battle of the Bands for young people. This starts a little earlier at 7 and goes on until 10:30. You'll be sure of getting a variety of different music from the young talent from the area. To find both of these places, go left out of the front of the hotel and walk down the road. You'll come to the Playhouse first. Then there's a garage, and the Summer Showhouse is just after that. If you still fancy some more time on or near the beach, there is a firework display being held at 10 o'clock at the end of the pier. You won't be allowed onto the pier at this time, so I think the best place to see it is on the beach with some friends. This can be very popular, so make sure you arrive in good time to get a good view. If there's no room, you can watch from the path or the areas behind the path. Some people have asked me about food, and there are plenty of restaurants and cafes all around the area near the hotel. A bonus for you is that there is a culinary festival this weekend. This takes place from around 6 in the town centre. There will be kiosks all around the square serving food and drinks from a variety of different cultures. Some of these will be fairly familiar, such as Chinese, Indian, French, Italian and Thai, but others will be less common. Examples will be Scandinavian, West African, Polynesian and Siberian, amongst others. This will all go on until around 12. Now, if it's raining and there is a storm forecast, everything will still be going on, but don't forget an umbrella. However, if the rain puts you off, there's a cinema about 5 minutes walk away from the hotel. Just turn right when you leave the hotel. Another option is the comedy club, though this starts a little later and is a bit further away, needing a taxi rather than a walk or a bus to get there. Doors open at 9 and it goes on until midnight. It costs $10 to go in.
That is the end of section 2. You will now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section 3. Section 3. You will hear a student being interviewed at a university. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 25. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 25.
So thanks for coming in for this interview at our university, Richard.
Thanks for asking me, Dr. Langer.
So I can see from your application form that you took a year off.
Yes, that's right.
Can you tell me about it?
As you know, I did French and German at school, but I wanted to learn a language that was not from Europe before I started doing modern languages at university.
Where did you go?
I decided to go to Cairo to learn Arabic.
Did you have any basic Arabic before you went?
I studied it myself a little bit, but it wasn't much to prepare for being in Cairo.
Did you do a course?
Not straight away. I couldn't afford it. After getting somewhere to live, I got a job in a sports club. I'm a good tennis player, and I gave lessons at a local tennis club in the mornings and afternoons.
Did you need a work permit?
Theoretically, yes, but the tennis club wasn't worried about that. Later, when I saved some money, I took an Arabic course. My parents helped out with the cost of that as well.
Did you find Arabic difficult?
It depends. Initially it was hard, as it was so different, but I soon found out that the grammar was very straightforward. I found the pronunciation really difficult, and the reading also was really hard. I had to master the alphabet before I could start to make sense of it.
When did you start to become operational in Arabic?
In speaking, I could start having conversations after a couple of months. I had lots of opportunity at the tennis club to practice, but it was in the evenings when I would go to cafes and talk with people there that my spoken Arabic really took off. The locals were very friendly and delighted that I was trying to learn their language. Most people would chat to me.
And the reading and writing?
That took a lot longer and I'm still not great at it now. The good thing about the writing, though, is that all Arabic is the same when written, whereas the speaking versions can vary in dialects in all Arabic-speaking countries.
How did you like the food?
Cairo is a very cosmopolitan city, and you can get all sorts of food there. The basic fare is rice, breads, grilled meats and salads. They also have lots of great dips to eat with vegetables and bread. I loved it. You had to learn where to go, though, as the quality could be variable.
You now have some time to look at questions 26 to 30. Now listen to the rest of the interview and answer questions 26 to 30.
I'm glad you seem to enjoy your year in Cairo. So which two languages would you like to specialise in here?
That's a difficult question, as I'd like to continue with my French and German, but I don't want to abandon my Arabic. It would also be fun and useful to do another language from scratch. I'd be really keen to learn Chinese.
We don't offer that here, I'm afraid, though we do the others.
I think I'll go for the Arabic and my best European language. My German is a bit rusty, but I also practice my French in Egypt. I'll go for the French, I think.
That would be a good mixture.
Can I ask a couple of questions?
Of course.
I'd like first to know how the course is taught. I guess the usual university lecture style isn't suited to languages.
No, although when you study literature in your chosen languages, there are lectures. The first year of the course focuses on your getting a good knowledge of the grammar and vocabulary of your languages. This is done in kind of school-type lessons. Through the year, the key areas of grammar are covered. For developing your vocabulary, students will be assigned various readings on particular topics. These then will be discussed in smaller seminars.
How many people are in a seminar?
Usually 6 to 10. These sessions are led by a native speaker of your languages, and the focus will be on developing fluency in speech and vocabulary.
That sounds good.
The second year continues with lessons to cover grammar, though usually more obscure or difficult points. The speaking seminars are replaced by seminars on literature and cultural topics. These seminars will be led by the same teachers as in the first year. There'll be lectures on literature as well.
And the third year?
You spend that in countries that speak the languages you're studying. You spend 5 months in each country.
What will I do in these countries?
You can either study or work. You have to study in a university that runs an approved program, or do a job that we agree to.
Can I get any help with these?
Yes. You can organise things yourself, but you have to make sure that the course you choose to study at the foreign university has to be an approved program. If you can't find anything, we have a list of suitable universities in various countries, and these universities are used to students coming from us. Jobs are probably harder to organise. You, of course, may have some friends overseas now who might be able to help. A lot of students have family who have business relationships in other countries, and that can be a good way to find a suitable temporary job. If you want a job and can't find one, we have some contacts that we can use to place you.
And year four is back at the university, I suppose?
That's right. The grammar classes will be over then, but you'll have seminars discussing language points that you or your teachers bring up. Then there'll be more lectures on literature in the languages that you'll be studying.
I expect year four will have the final exams. Is that right?
Oh yes. You will have a series of exams. There will be an oral exam, which will be conducted by a native speaker teacher. That will be in early May. Then at the start of June, the written exams will come. There will be two translation exams, a listening exam, and two exams on literature. The literature exams will depend on which topics you choose. Your final course grade will be based on these exams combined with various assignments set over the course and a third-year dissertation.
That is the end of Section 3. You will now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to Section 4. Section 4. You will hear part of an anthropology lecture on the match. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Now listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this lecture on anthropology. Today we look at the phenomenon of fire and how the match was developed in our society. Fire was a basic need for modern humankind and a catalyst for the expansion of our ancestors beyond the borders of Africa. It gave us the power to survive in harsh environments, process food, and change the shape of the environment we live in. As time passed, the ability to create fire became commonplace all around the world. However, that process was still slow, as fire is unreliable and dependent upon many conditions, such as rain and wind. Fire was also hard to move. Because of these problems, many scientists of the early human civilizations tried to find some way to make fire easy to create, portable, and reliable. Because they lacked the knowledge of chemistry and physics, their early efforts were unsuccessful. The only relatively successful example of the early control over fire came from 5th century AD China, where sulfur-coated wooden sticks were used as a catalyst to create fire. By the 10th century, manufacture of these fire inch sticks could be found in all parts of China. A 1,000 years passed and scientists still did not come close to finding the way to create a self-igniting source of fire that could be used reliably by the general population. The basis of the modern match and lighter technology was founded in the second half of the 17th century by the alchemist Hennig Brandt, who dreamed of creating gold from other metals his entire life. During his career, he managed to extract pure phosphorus and test its flammable properties. His notes proved to be an important stepping stone for future generations of inventors. The first match was created in 1805 by Jean Chancel in Paris. This crude match looked nothing like the modern striking matches we use today. Instead of using phosphorus, Chancel coated wooden sticks with potassium chlorate, sulfur, sugar, rubber, and then dipped these sticks into a small asbestos bottle filled with sulfuric acid. Unfortunately, nasty fumes were released when the connection between the acid and the mixture on the stick was made to create fire. This could and did make many users of Chancel's match sick. The method was also a bit complicated, needing always a bottle of sulfuric acid at hand, and so did not achieve widespread popularity. The next innovation in matches was introduced to the public in 1826 by John Walker, an English chemist. He devised a way of igniting the match through using friction. The matches were made by combining a paste of sulphur with gum, potassium chlorate, sugar, and ignited by drawing the match between a fold of sandpaper. Between 1827 and 1829, Walker managed to develop his invention's use, but soon his invention lost popularity due to its danger. A flaming ball of material often separated from the rest of the match, falling to the floor and destroying carpets and dresses. Because of this, Walker's matches were quickly banned in France and Germany. The next step was in the 1830s with the invention of the white phosphorus match by Frenchman Charles Sorier. This match worked well, but it had the disadvantage of self-lighting when no one was around, with the obvious results. By 1850, many countries banned production and sale of these dangerous objects. Replacements for white phosphorus matches were safety matches that were developed by the Swede Johan Lundström in the late 1840s, although a different Swede had actually first patented this process. By utilising red phosphorus only on the striking surface and not on the match itself, the matches were made perfectly safe for the environment and health. By 1858, Lundström had industrial manufacturing capabilities to create 12 million matchboxes per year, and from that point on, their popularity rose until this match became the iconic object that is used today all around the world. The problem of dangerous gas release was also solved by Lundström's safety match. The red phosphorus used does not release the same gases as white phosphorus. When the match is struck, the flame proceeds down the wooden stick, leaving only harmless charcoal behind, which is easily digestible by the environment when thrown away. When the flame is burning on the safety match, there are three phases of gas that are released. First and closest to the match is a hot pyrolysis gas. This is not dangerous to people, though of course it would burn the skin of anyone who came into contact with it. As the hot pyrolysis gas cools, it becomes a luminous yellow gas, which again would only be harmful because it is still relatively hot. Finally, as the luminous gas cools, the combustion products of the gases are released, which is seen as the orange flame that everyone recognises. These products dissipate into the air.
That is the end of section 4. You will now have half a minute to check your answers. That is the end of listening test 6. In the IELTS test, you would now have 10 minutes to transfer your answers to the listening answer sheet.